You can look at regional issues. In Europe, Chechnya and Bosnia sort of stand out. Africa, Rwanda, Somalia, Angola, right now, other frontline states in their relation to South Africa. Middle East, of course. Turkey, with the Kurds recently, has been a shooting kind of a conflict. In Asia, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, North Korea come to mind. Latin America, Guatemala's been in the news again, El Salvador. Conflicts between several other countries. Peru was involved in one recently. And if you want the sort of the cross threads, you would look at issues like refugees, like the international arms trade, efforts on the positive side, like peacekeeping and peacemaking, economic sanctions, and so forth. And my thought was to basically do it in terms of questions that you have, but to look to cover at least a few of the threads going in each direction, because I think there's some ways that they enrich our understanding of the overall picture, even though we won't talk about every conflict in the world or every issue that one could use to connect them. And if you haven't started rolling the tape already, you're welcome to. My name is Glenn Gersmell, and the topic is sorting out the international, or the new world disorder. I believe it is the way we put it. So, is there a particular area of the world or issue that you're interested in us taking a look at?
I'll start us off. I'm going down to Guatemala in about a month.
Right.
And with a medical group. And since I've been gone, I don't know what's happening, but you said recently as to what is happening.
Yeah, the last couple months.
There. I was down there last summer.
Right.
And it can be a little intimidating as the army walks around everywhere with their automatic weapons around you.
Right. Well, the issue that has been in the news is a couple American citizens, the husband of a lawyer and a second person, I can't remember the context, had disappeared and were suspected killed, and Kin wanted to know what was the story. I mean, what did the military know? What did the U.S. consulate know, etc.? And the truth was known in both camps and was not forthcoming. And the lawyer whose husband had disappeared went on a hunger fast that resulted in about a dozen, including several lengthy articles in the New York Times in a span of a little over a week. I mean, it was sort of blew it open, and many, many other media covered it as well. And it turned out that the CIA had been funneling $5 to $7 million in military aid to Guatemala at a time when that sort of aid was not supposed to be going there. It was illegal. And the upper level officer that was ultimately fingered for the murder of one of the people had been trained at the notorious School of the Americas here in the United States, that has trained officers from most of the Latin American countries in counterinsurgency techniques. And there was a bill in Congress. One of the principal sponsors was Joseph Kennedy from Massachusetts, to close down the school. It got more than 100 votes, I believe, last year. That is a year ago this summer, and now has been reintroduced, and they hope to get another vote. The bad news is the character of Congress has changed somewhat. The committee chairs, who have almost total power over hearings and pace of bills and markup and so forth, are less sympathetic, to say the least. Particularly on the Senate side, we have Jesse Helms, you know, chairing the Foreign Relations Committee, from the state where this, one of these training camps is located, North Carolina. But on the positive side, the folks that have been working on that issue have, through the Freedom of Information Act, gotten a list of all the people that went to the school, and have at this, also have the list from the UN Commission that investigated a whole range of abuses in Latin America, and have done a matchup. And it constitutes the basic flyer of the campaign against the School of the Americas, and it is among the most provocative, shocking, transparent, outrageous single sheets of paper, I think, in print today, because the assassination of Archbishop Romero, the killing of the six Jesuit priests and their two house workers, prominent case after case, the killing of the four American women, church women that worked down there. There's a list of perhaps 15 or 18 of such atrocities that the matchup is 3 out of 7 people fingered by the UN Commission were trained at the School of the Americas. 14 out of 17 officers indicted trained at the School of the Americas. 7 out of 13, indicted by the government but never brought to trial, trained at the School of the Americas, and it just goes down the list. The total represents, by my recollection, over half of the people involved. And the total numbers of people that have floated through these schools are very large, and the basic kind of overarching vision of these schools is the suppression of dissent. And the targets of the activities of the people that go through these schools have typically been religious workers, priests, nuns, and lay workers who have been involved in anything remotely resembling social justice, labor organizing, peasant organizing, and I'm not talking revolutionary organizing, I'm talking about trying to get a co-op involved. A friend of mine was a Catholic priest in Bolivia, who talked about people coming back from this training school and bringing along equipment that they had that came hand in hand with it, and the strikes and protests in his shantytown took on a different coloration when these Cadillac gauge armored cars with the very powerful water cannons mounted on the top, and as well as the machine guns, but the water cannons just blowing away people, just knocking them over, at 100 yards. Very powerful water cannons just really took the stuffings out of the attempts for people to protest to get clean water pipes out to their shanty town. Another priest told me the story that they had trained several hundred people from the local parishes in just basic skills of organizing cooperatives and getting people together and supporting and encouraging their activity. And the government asked for a list of the people that had gone through the training program of the Catholic Church to do follow-up, and then went out and killed them. Just really unbelievable level of violence. And where there are people in the United States who would support suppression of far left, or to a lesser extent, you find that you hear people calling for suppression of far right, that is really extremist kinds of characters. I mean, these were people like Rigoberto Menchu, picked up off the street and disappeared for a while or forever. It's an amazing gap between the knowledge of people like ourselves who have seen, the films on the School of the Americas or other kinds of documents, heard people speak, from these countries, and the majority of the people who still hold to this fantasy that the majority of the things that the United States is doing in the world are benign in some fashion. And I wish it were true. I think there are lots of things that we do that are good, but there are both an incredible number of things that are, hand in glove with some of the worst things that are happening in the hemisphere. Or there are there are the kinds of things that a close friend of mine in the last parish that I was in before moving to Massachusetts had worked at a medical clinic in Central America. And in his town, the majority of people ate meat once a month, maybe twice. And he reported that a number of years ago, when there was a substantial hike in the price of meat in the United States, that, you know, receiving a weekly newspaper from the United States, he observed that meat just vanished from the diet of the people in his town. It just wasn't even available anymore. People would have to travel into a large city, you know, 70 miles away to add that back into their diet. And it was just a really striking kind of an example of something that I would be surprised if there are 20 people in the entire United States that knows that that act in the United States had this effect in a third world country. And, you know, we're like this blind elephant that is sort of moving around in the china shop, and things are falling off the shelves every time we move. And we don't even know about it, you know. Not only do the majority of people have very little understanding or knowledge of the more egregious kinds of things that happen, but just these basic kinds of day-to-day activities that shift things in our economy have these tremendous repercussions in the rest of the world. And it seems to me irresponsible for us to not, over a period of years, be able to get our act together as a church or as a community or as a media to educate the American public about those effects and to allow us in a democracy to be able to exercise some kind of moral judgment to add that at the very least, if not make it a veto kind of a situation over economic kinds of decisions that are made in the world. So I think Guatemala is both a place where, you know, the spotlight has been on a certain set of abuses, but it's also a place that I think reminds us and represents, something larger. I'll share one of a variety of bright things that I could, bright spots or positive things that I could say about it. I spoke with the fellow in the Catholic Archdiocese in Seattle, responsible for the peace and justice portfolio, and the Archdiocese has 15 copies of the Mary Knoll film, School of the Assassins, same letters as School of the Americas. Pretty strong video. I recommend it as both a responsible treatment, but also one that doesn't pull a lot of punches. And he says it's not very often that there's more than one or two in the office, that they're all out there being shown in every parish in the archdiocese. And I asked, is it mainly being shown in more liberal audiences? The stereotype is it's the liberals that care about these things, the bleeding hearts. And he said, no, not at all. I mean, it's across the board. I think it's a model or an example of what could be happening in the Lutheran churches as well. And there's no reason why, with our links with countries around the world, that we couldn't be educating our constituency to the extent that video represented educational effort going on there. And things will change if we can do that. They will not change if we don't.
Two things that help keep Guatemala in perspective for me. One is that there have been some significant strides, at least in dialogue towards a peace process in Mexico. But you have to realize that there is an oligarchy that has a tremendous amount to lose if that thing goes forward. And so it doesn't take a lot to figure out that they're going to go to sabotage the peace process in any way that they can. And these various, I think a lot of things are staged by the military to make sure that they do get in to keep power and keep control. Second thing is I really believe that the indigenous Mayan people are considered as less than human.
Right.
And, if human rights, if you're not a human, you don't have human rights. And I think that's how somebody who has power can look at that.
Right.
And then the third thing, just a comment, and it's really frustrating trying to understand what's going on down there because there's no news that we get up here.
Right.
And what I do have access to is slanted so far left sometimes that I don't think it's got credibility. So where do you get credible news?
I subscribe to the New York Times at great expense. It's about $400 a year now. And I read The Progressive in these times, The Nation on the left, the academic publications include World Policy Journal and Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy and a few others. Harvard Review of International Affairs has some really excellent articles occasionally. I read quite a bit of defense and military publications, and I subscribe to U.S. News and World Report and a variety of right-of-center or center publications to try to keep it balanced. And it's remarkable that, I mean, nobody has a lock on the truth. I mean, the National Review occasionally will do really superb, you know, responsible reporting or editorializing. I use it more often to sort of wake me up those mornings when things are going sort of slow in my metabolism. But it's, I read pretty widely and try to keep, I have friends that will send me articles from the LA Times and some of the other regional newspapers that are good, Boston Globe, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and a few others. But NPR and news, and also one of our NPR stations carries the, or National Public Radio stations carries the British, news, hour length, much more in-depth international coverage than just about anything in the United States except the New York Times and the Washington Post.
You're in Seattle. You're in Seattle.
Right.
The Unitarian Congregation.
Right.
Always had a really in-depth data.
Just make one comment about the Mayans. They're majority of the population in Guatemala and are virtually totally disenfranchised. It was the group that was that the Catholics were attempting to give some aid to in supporting indigenous leadership development. One of the unspoken realities of our world is that there are approximately 180 plus states in the world, but there's, depending upon how you count it, 3,000 to 6,000 nations. So, for example, the Kurds is a nation with a definable language, religious, structure, culture, etc., but has no state. Its peoples are spread in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey. And yet, as a nation, it is larger than more than half of the states in the United Nations. Is that clear? A nation is a people. A state is a political entity. And the majority of states in the world are multinational. Multi-ethnic. And we conceive of ourselves as having a much more diverse melting pot or multicultural reality in the United States than most other countries, but we don't really know what it's like to have entire nations within our borders. Native American peoples represent different nations. That's the closest we come to it. But there are countries with much larger nations bound up within the state. And of course, a part of the history of colonialism was drawing lines between states that would actually separate and divide nations to reduce their power. That happened in the Middle East. One of the best books about Africa has the title The Scramble for Africa. At the turn of the century, there was an effort by the European powers to grab the last remaining plots on earth that hadn't yet had a flag planted on it and declared in property of so and so queen or king and etc. It bore no sensitivity to the actual divisions of the different peoples there. So you have in a French protectorate, or former colony, Tutu and Tutsi and Hutu, in the same state where they shouldn't have ever been. I mean, there should have been a line. And frequently, the colonial power will empower a minority group within that culture and have them more educated, have their people sent over to the parent country's universities and come back as civil servants to run things, in part as part of that strategy of divide and conquer. And we've seen that all over the world. So the legacy of colonialism is a big part of this picture, and nobody seems to want to talk about it or acknowledge it. I mean, it's one thing to open, you know, to be willing to have reparations or something like that, which, you know, a good case could be made for it. But it's another thing to not ever even notice. And not just the long-term colonialism going way back. How about short-term effects? For example, Somalia. I've probably seen 400 reports on it. I think the majority of people have seen at least 200 reports on Somalia in the last couple years. Is that about ballpark between newspaper and television reports? Think of those, let's say, 200 reports. How many of them thought that it would be useful information to share with the reading or listening public that the United States was the principal supplier of arms and military training and support to the despotic Siad Barre regime from 1986 to 1991. Siad Barre might be mentioned. He took a hike in 91 when he pretty much destroyed the political opposition. It was no miracle at all that there were warring factions at that point. He had made it difficult for anyone else to succeed him because he'd eliminated most of the opposition. With our acknowledgement and we were aware of what was going on, we didn't really do anything about it, but that didn't seem to be very high in our priorities. You know, we claim to be in places like Somalia to build democracy. That's what we heard all through the latter part of the 80s. Key area of the Horn of Africa, strategic importance, blah, blah, blah. But oh, democracy was always there. But the reality was the opposite. We had tolerated one of the least democratic folks around. And when he took a walk, there wasn't much left. And for us to claim that we're the cavalry going in to save these poor, primitive peoples from their base instincts of warring with one another is just this incredibly, outrageous in terms of what the truth is actually is in the area. We played some positive, functions there. And for those of you that were at any of the talks on nonviolence, the amazing thing is that 31 Rangers get killed in a very, very questionable attempt to grab ID'd one of those so-called warlords. And that proves that nonviolence doesn't work. Peacekeeping is just too costly. Pull out. But, you know, if 10,000 people die in a war or 50,000 in Korea, we have a totally different standard to evaluate peacekeeping and military activity. You know, 107,000 people have died in military activity in the 20th century, and we have not yet found it in our national consciousness and discussion to conclude that violence doesn't work. That we ought to put all of our eggs in nonviolent activities, or at least give them a good try. So. I think those are a couple of those other strands: indigenous peoples, and colonialism, and the self-interest of major powers, and then their capacity to obliterate history or keep it down. You know, like if it's an AK-47 that shoots an American troop, you hear about it. What kind of weapons do you think brought down those two Black Hawk helicopters and killed those 30-some Rangers in that last operation before we left Somalia? I'd lay good money, having been the major arms supplier to Somalia in those years, that those were M-16s and U.S. shoulder-fired rockets of a much more primitive version than the Stingers that, after the Afghan conflict had spread all over the terrorist movements of the world. But that's something that is not convenient, to be out there, and therefore it doesn't get published as well as easily. It comes out occasionally, but not that whole
that whole slice of the truth doesn't very often get out there. Other conflicts or other aspects of conflict that you'd like to have us talk a little bit about or share your own thoughts on?
I find it interesting that the United States or world large powers come in and say they're peacekeepers in nations, and actually they are more or less coming in and working in conflict and call themselves peacekeepers.
Right. I've spoken with quite a few people in the UN, including several of the heads of major segments of the folks that are in Bosnia right now or in Somalia. And there's a very healthy and very, I think, positive, forward-looking debate going on in the international diplomatic community and in the UN and its assorted organizations on the necessity to clarify and be much more thoughtful about where is the dividing line between peacekeeping, which has been a traditional UN activity, and peacemaking, which is a task that one could make a case for doing in certain situations, but is a very different kind of operation. And the point where you try to do both, you're in real trouble, like Somalia. I mean, you cannot claim to be above the fray and to be there for humanitarian reasons on the one hand and have all of these UN workers without military support spread all over the country and be bombing one of the participants of the conflict and stay above the fray. I mean, it just conceptually doesn't work very well, and it certainly hasn't worked very well on the ground. And that's not to say that, I'm not at this point arguing for or against NATO attacks on Serb artillery positions, but rather to say that there are real apples and oranges, or oil and water. You really can have both going on at the same time. Historically, the United Nations has rightly, I think, understood that peacekeeping works when you have a treaty that the various factions agree to, or at least largely agree to, and they all are in favor of UN, personnel coming in to help maintain and expand and implement the peace so that the folks on all of the participating parties can get on with the business of rebuilding or constructing or democratizing or functioning. I think we're going to see the light of day on this one. And Bosnia is at this point a special case because it's already the opportunities that if you read back in the newspapers, you can see all of the places where there were opportunities for the West, in particular Europe, to have done something, and they did not. History will look very, very badly and negatively on Europe in particular, and a couple steps behind the United States' inability to do the smart thing and the responsible thing and the humane thing. And, what we have going on in Bosnia is the closest thing to genocide since World War II. In Europe, and you can give all kinds of excuses for that in terms of political turmoil in the various European powers. Germany can't do it because it had a very sordid role in World War II. It had basically armed the Croats against the Serbs up until a year and a half ago. There were more Serbs that were killed by the Croats, armed and backed by the Nazis, than had suffered the reverse up to now. The Serbs have long since vastly exceeded that, and I think are rightly being fingered as the bad guys at this point. But and in fact, one of the tragedies is that news reports gradually get sloppier and sloppier, or more devious. I hope it's the first. And so you see the legitimate Bosnian government being represented as a mere warring party, which is just not true. I mean, there's a difference when you're defending your own legitimate state or when you're attacking and, ethnic cleansing an area. I mean, there's a difference between those two. They are not equal. And so I think some creativity there and some guts on the part of some courage, moral courage, and public insistence on activity there that would acknowledge the reality and say on behalf of, you know, the so-called civilized world, this cannot happen. You know, this is not acceptable. Genocide and, you know, rape as a military strategy. These are not acceptable kinds of things. You know, the world community can step in and say no in effective ways. Yeah.
And when you were saying that historically, when you look back, we'll see that there were many times that
right.
Europe, especially, or the U.S. could have intervened.
Right.
And what solutions would you have suggested earlier on in the conflict?
Right. I'm increasing violence as the way to resolve conflict, to bring about justice. And typically, the places where it looks like it doesn't work, like people make the case that, you know, well, what about Hitler, you know? They reserve for themselves the right to start the clock at 1939, when most of the opportunities to deal with the situation with nonviolence have been exhausted. And, you know, it doesn't look so possible. Gandhi never tired of saying, you know, if someone is, you know, coming to harm your family, it is better to grab whatever weapon is there than to be a coward and run and leave your family defenseless. That was his answer to that question of, you know, what the what ifs. I should say that Walter Wink has several fabulous chapters devoted to those kinds of questions. One of them, I think, even is entitled "But What If." He gives this great story, for example. William Jennings Bryan once visited Tolstoy and pressed him with the perennial problem of what to do if a criminal is about to kill a child. Tolstoy responded that having lived 75 years, he had never, except in discussions, encountered that fantastic brigand who before my eyes desired to kill or violate a child, but that perpetually I did and do see not one but millions of brigands using violence toward children and women and men and old people and all the laborers in the name of the recognized right of violence over one's fellows. That is war, state instituted violence. When I said this, my kind interlocutor, with his naturally quick perception, not giving me time to finish, laughed and recognized that my argument was satisfactory. So I guess the point is a couple things. One, to understand that we're in a relatively primitive state of the development of nonviolence. Wink has this brilliant quote from David Dellinger comparing the place of the development of nonviolence as a practice and as a theory as about the time of Marconi and Edison and the development of a new source of power that we've learned to apply to a few things but haven't yet really, scratched the surface of understanding the manifold ways in which it can be applied in the world. And I think that's true. I mean, nonviolence isn't just something that we opt for and then go back to our lives and continue about our work. I mean, as a Christian, I feel compelled to engage in a lifelong project of learning not only the theory, reading Gandhi, but also the practice, the stories, the countless stories of nonviolent activity, and the lessons that can be learned, and practicing it, taking the effort to override old habits and construct new ones to deal with situations. He has an appendix where he lists a chronology of more than a dozen pages, I think, and several hundred cases of the use of nonviolence to deal with conflicts. And one of the most remarkable, and I'll read just a paragraph or two of it, addresses what the opponents of nonviolence, or the cynics about nonviolence, feel is their trump card, and they often play it first just to end the discussion. What about Hitler? Wink says, nonviolence did work whenever it was tried against the Nazis. The bishop in Bulgaria, for example, told the Nazi authorities if they attempted to deport Bulgarian Jews to concentration camps, he himself would lead a campaign of civil disobedience, lie down on the railroad tracks in front of the trains.
Thousands of Bulgarians, Jews, and non-Jews resisted all collaboration with Nazi decrees, march, mass street demonstrations, a flood of letters and telegrams. Bottom line, Romania at first persecuted the, I'm sorry, jumped ahead here. Because of these and other non-military measures, all of Bulgaria's Jewish citizens were saved from the Nazi death camps. He goes on to do the same story with Romania, Finland, Denmark, Holland, and Norway. The truth is, not that nonviolence did not work against the Nazis, but that it was so seldom utilized. The Jews themselves did not use it, but continued to rely in the main on the passive non-resistance that had carried them through so many pogroms of the past. No criticism of them. And the churches as a whole were too docile or anti-Semitic and too ignorant of the nonviolent message of the gospel to act effectively to resist the Nazis or act in solidarity with the Jews. The foremost military writer of our time, Lavelle Hart, discovered in his interrogation of Nazi generals after World War II, they had little trouble dealing with the violent resistance they encountered, like in the Balkans or Russia, but they expressed complete inability to cope with nonviolence as practiced in Denmark, Holland, Norway, and to a lesser extent, France and Belgium. They were experts in violence, trained to cope with opponents who used that method. Other forms of resistance baffled them. The trump card, the most common challenge thrown back to those that oppose nonviolence, turns out to be wrong. And the countless times through history, I mean, just in our time, the Philippines, most of the Eastern European states, and South Africa all fell because of nonviolent campaigns of resistance, and with the church being a central force in all three of them. Christians played a central, massive, major role in all three. And yet, you'd read the, you know, Christian publications, you'd hardly know that was the case. I mean, there's been some reporting, but we're at a moment, I think, in history where there's going to be a change. There's an opportunity like I haven't seen in my lifetime to an openness to talk about these things, fueled on the grassroots by violence in our streets, but with models in the public world that are just indisputable. If we just take a little bit of time to learn the stories, and most of them are, two-thirds of them are in Wink, a good many more are in a book that came out just this year, really amazing, An Ethic for Enemies, Forgiveness in Politics. And it gives me tremendous hope for these conflicts around the world. I mean, the truth is that with the Cold War off, you know, there are a couple possibilities. I mean, the United States is moving into a really horrendous role as the major arms supplier of the world. Our share of arms trade to the third world has jumped from between 8 and 30% in the 80s to last year, 73% of all the arms sold for the third world came from the United States. And we've actively pursued that role. Our Commerce Department and its secretary, Ron Brown, have had a larger role in that than the Defense Department or the State Department. I mean, it's driven by economics. And if you're interested, we may not get into it here. There's an article from the Wall Street Journal and on the flip side, the business section of the New York Times that really devastate the economic argument that those are needed. They do not provide more jobs. They certainly don't provide more jobs than if we use the same $7 or $8 billion a year of our tax money that supports those arms sales, put that into other places where there are real jobs to be, you know, had. We would do much better economically. I mean, there are really big areas of international trade. We could brainstorm a list in a flash: fiber optics, high definition television, you know, computers, sustainable agricultural implements and technologies and resources and fertilizers and so forth. I mean, just there are huge areas where modest amounts of government support could pay off really big in terms of us, you know, having international trade in not the $30, $50, and $60 billion range like the arms trade, but in the $100, $200, and $500 billion range like these areas that I just mentioned here. And, you know, the knowledge in this room could come up with a dozen more.
Do you feel that handguns, which are kept in the home by the bedside for, so you know, for protection or self-defense or whatever,
right,
Do they have a role in a nonviolent society? I mean, I'm having a hard time reconciling that.
Fabulous question.
That comment you made about Gandhi there.
Well, the FBI itself says that those handguns are more than 100 times more likely to be used to kill your neighbor's child, or your neighbor's child kill your child, or you kill your cousin in a fit of rage, or your uncle who drinks too much knows where it is and grabs it when there's a fight going on, or an accident. 100 times more likely than any self-defense scenario. New England Journal of Medicine had a much more stringent set of criteria and determined this last year that a gun is 43 times more likely to kill, you know, a neighbor or a friend than to be used against an assailant. And both are useful statistics. Both are impeccable sources. The most prestigious medical journal in the world, or in the United States anyway, the world probably, and you know, the FBI statistics, the most comprehensive set of statistics on crime.
But does that address the philosophical idea of, if you're going to be nonviolent, can you have that sort of lethal weapon to defend yourself around?
Yeah, I guess I personally view, having come from a family that, I mean, my options were join the Navy or become a grade school teacher. I mean, it's just not in my constitution to be a pacifist. I'm being persuaded by the evidence. But I don't need to impose an answer to that question as a kind of a rule that comes out of nonviolence. I think your instinct about that probably doesn't, that gun doesn't end up in the home because of it, you know, is accurate. But I think different people, particularly in our culture that has such a legacy of violence and gun ownership for all kinds of other reasons, and there's been such a mythology that's developed over individualism and, you know, the Second Amendment and so forth, that I think a lot of people's paths won't be my telling them, you ought to, you know, that's ridiculous, get rid of that gun or don't come back to a discussion about nonviolence. And what I'm trying to say is I'm more interested in what is each person's path in wrestling with these issues, and they'll deal with that and at the point where it's appropriate. And I'll lay good money on them bringing it down to the city square at some point when there'll be thousands of people gathering and putting their guns into big bins and having them melted down in front of their eyes and crafted into art objects. I mean, we're going to see that in the next 5 and 10 years. I mean, the biggest art object at the churchwide assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in Minneapolis will be in a space almost the size of this room, a huge construction made out of plastic, you know, and other toy guns and weapons. And if you have any, you're welcome to send them in, or if you know people in your congregation, by the middle of July is their deadline. The name of the person to call about it or to mail it to is in the LPF newsletter, this issue. And you know, you and your friends or your congregation or the kids in your Sunday school could all be a part of this really astonishing thing they're doing. The artistic design has something, you know, some kind of conversion motif of these. You'll see the shapes of the weapons more clearly in one side, and it moves over to the other side to be something much more humane. And that's about as far as I can describe it, because it's one of these in-process kind of art enterprises. But that will be the largest single installation at our churchwide assembly. I think it's great. And I mean, there's the energy that is flowering around this country is not to be believed. They're just astonishing things that are happening. People are just taking matters into their hands and doing creative things that I think are models of what could happen beyond that. And which is not to say that there aren't some very disturbing trends beneath the surface of people whose idea of solving the crime problem is building more prisons. You know, we have twice as many prison cells now as we had 10 or 12 years ago, and it hasn't worked, to my eyes. And more than that, we're at the breaking point now in terms of prison costs. It's very expensive to build a prison. It is really expensive to keep them operating. You've heard the statistic. For the price of housing one prisoner in a modern cell in Washington State, you can send two people to Harvard for a year. And not to mention a whole lot of other alternative kinds of institutions that, that could actually do something to change the problem. We're at the point where we're in the process of building in the next few years, in just to take our state, Washington State, enough prison cells to, in 5 or 6 or 7 years, virtually dry up the available social service resources that ought to be going for prevention, but for some harebrained reason is going for... Corrections isn't the right word, is it?
I have a question.
Punitive.
What are they doing in other countries?
This isn't my area of expertise, particularly the other countries part, so I probably would be the wisest to beg off. I've read, you know, a variety of creative ways that other countries deal with it. I mean, police and criminal justice structures are, you know, there's lots of models out there.
Because if we're doing so much prison building in the United States, I'd be curious to know what other countries are they building as rapidly as we are? What's happening? And if not, what is happening?
We are at the point where there's only one other country in the entire world that has a higher percentage of its population in prisons. We passed South Africa.
What is that other country?
Russia. I wouldn't want to be in charge of the Russian version of the Justice Department and the FBI for anything with the mafia and all the other kinds of things that are happening there.
But I guess I'm still, and I don't mean to draw on the knowledge that you don't have.
Yeah.
My curiosity is, in the European countries, what are they doing? I'd be very, very interested in knowing how they're dealing with their criminal justice system.
Much more effort into prevention.
Okay.
And, I mean, the couple of days ago we had on the board, and tomorrow morning we'll have on the board again, we took the figures of the number of people killed by firearms in 1 year from 7 different countries, and then one of the folks working on it did the math and found out how many it is per million people. So you can really compare countries. I mean, big countries, little countries, right? That was always a problem. And it was really interesting. And I mean, I saw some things in it that I haven't seen before, and I've worked with those numbers for quite a while. I mean, not having them here, I won't go further on it, but I could dig them out by the end of the session if you're interested. Yeah.
The discussion really comes home to me, and I'll share something about my background. I happen to be a Christian who believes with all his heart in what nonviolence, you know, we should be nonviolent. I also happen to be a commissioned officer who wears a gun.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't think it puts you in a struggle mode, I have never resolved the issue in my own mind. I do know that in my heart I believe that's the answer. I also know in my particular area, the fish and wildlife law enforcement, I do know when I get the call at 2 o'clock in the morning that there's a poacher out there with a rifle, I would have a real hard time going out there by myself and confronting that armed person with purely the message of Christianity and not something strapped on my head. Now, I'm talking as a Christian who has not been able to resolve that issue, but I do know that when and it's a very tough one for me, and I mean, if it's tough for me, what must it be on a world, you know?
Yeah.
But as a human being, I have not been able to resolve that issue because when I'm confronted with pure evil in my area, and it's when I'm confronting that alone while other people sleep, somehow I can't put myself to go into that situation.
Right.
Purely on my faith.
Again, it comes back to at what point do you start the clock? And if you're being put into the position where you've already got a culture that's produced the people that are doing the poaching and their attitudes toward the guns and what they might do to you and what their expectations are, what you're the person in your shoes is going to do. And if it's any comfort, I've worn a gun for a couple of years in a job that it was necessary or I determined that it was necessary in terms of advancement and so forth and so on. And my logic was in part, it was better for somebody who believed in nonviolence to be wearing a gun than some of the people that I met in the line of duty. And I've worked a good many of the years of my life with military officers on the strategy level and the planning level and the force structure level. And I felt it was useful to understand from the inside, you know, to let go of some of my myths and some of my stereotypes about it, to be able to deal with the issue more. I don't defend it. I would be happy to have anybody second guess those choices or to say that I was wrong or whatever, because ultimately I believe, I mean, I'm very close to the pacifist line in my own thinking, but I just don't think it's useful to criticize people for wearing a gun or to not acknowledge that in fact, in my experience, there are many more people who are in your shoes who understand what needs to happen and could be incredibly useful in moving toward a culture of nonviolence than the people who have had no experience and have only their sort of knee-jerk instincts about the matter. So again, I guess I'm sort of adding a little bit to some of the things I said over here that I think we're in a situation where we all need to just continue to do our best thinking about this and to wrestle with these issues and to not feel that it's simply, you know, it's not a question of the use of violence or not violence. That's not the question. Unfortunately, the term nonviolence is used both to mean satyagraha, Gandhi's term, which meant truth force, active nonviolence, but it's more commonly used to describe cowardice or passivism with a double S or not violence. We need some more words here, and we need to clarify what we're meaning and we need to help educate a whole generation of journalists and political leaders and activists and church leaders to what nonviolence is. And it's a whole world of understanding and of insight into the nature of power and into the nature of conflict and into what we're going to do, you know, with our future. And so it's really frustrating to be in a world where people feel that it's that the only question on the table is just, well, is it possible to get by in Bosnia without weapons? And that's maybe the 13th or 15th or 29th question, but there's a whole lot of really important questions and discussion that has to happen before then, including developing institutions that can respond to these kinds of things. It looks like we're going to be able to show a 15-minute video published and produced by the ELCA that is regarded as one of the most creative efforts ever to present to young people an option to military service as national service. And the title of it has the phrase, a global peace service in it. That is, why not create a kind of a Peace Corps structure and esprit and energy and training, level of training to fashion a substantial group of trained people to go into areas of conflict, to negotiate, to meet with and live with and work with the different sides of the conflict, to bring different groups together, you know, bring the doctors and the tradespeople and the religious leaders and the housewives together to work out and to get to understand one another better and to seek peace. Instead of the huge amount of money that we're spending exclusively on military forces that are largely unable and untrained to do those kinds of tasks. I mean, as we speak, a Lutheran project in Bosnia has 200 housewives from one of the combatant parties staying in the homes of one of the other combatant parties. So when the soldiers come from the visitors' ethnic group to knock on the door, they meet their kinsmen, who are basically, by their presence, saying, you do not violate a woman in this house. You do not break down the door here. You do not drive this person away. It's ended the conflict, in effect, for this brief moment anyway. We'll see where it goes from here. I mean, that's the kind of thing we need to hear about, but it's also a model of where we ought to be going, the kind of training and the kind of structures and the kind of institutions that can make a difference. And we're just, you know, it reminds me of, what was it, Newton, you know, was considered such a genius, and he once responded to a questioner. He says, you know, like, I'm like someone walking along the beach and occasionally picking up a more interesting or attractive shell and admiring it while the whole world of knowledge lies before me. Well, that's where we're at regarding the study and the practice of nonviolence. And, I mean, there's a whole world of creativity, of institutional structures, of training, of trial runs and experimentation and successes and failures and learning from failures that has to happen. And the end result is not as so many people, you know, read their newspaper and they read them like the sports page. You know, like who's winning and who's losing, you know. So politics, international relations have all been turned into sports. You know, like people want to see the gore on television and they want to know like who's winning and losing, you know, like what's happening to the balance sheet, you know, power politics. And that's just the worst of journalism and of citizenship.
How do you see both the World Council of Churches and actually the United Nations being a worker in trying to iron out a number of the conflicts that are?
How do I see those two
institutions?
Well, the World Council of Churches has funded a lot of interesting and creative projects. I mean, some haven't worked. Quite a few have been really great. Lutheran World Federation just came out with a study last summer, apparently. I've seen only a translation of it that is breaking some really important new ground on just war theory. United Nations, I think, does phenomenally well considering its handicaps. It lived for the first 50 years of its life totally under the shadow of the superpowers, largely of one of the two superpowers, the United States. And because of that, it was so constrained that the Security Council has, you know, all of the permanent members have veto power, that it became a place that third world countries, so-called third world countries, two-third world countries, would use to, like, send people that weren't working out, you know, they just didn't get along very well with the other people in the governing cabinet, and they would sort of bump someone up to the UN office, or there were, you know, the equivalent of kind of jet setters that would get into the UN because it was kind of nice parties and good food, you know, and fancy digs in New York. And there are a variety of other pernicious kinds of things that undermined it. I mean, any bureaucracy is going to have those sorts of problems, but there were some unique ones with the UN. I think it's astonishing that it's as effective as it is, that there is as many dedicated and creative and courageous people doing good things in the UN. I mean, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, I mean, there's a lot of potential there, and it's a crime that people will use it as a kind of a whipping boy for really, you know, narrow political gain on a partisan level in the United States political system. It deserves our support, as well as other institutions. I mean, the IMF and the World Bank have played a very, very terrible role in the two-thirds world on the issue of third world debt, for example, requiring countries, basically going into their budget process and requiring that they cut the safety net in order to be able to increase or maintain payments on debt to the banks in the United States and the third world lending institutions. I mean, there are countries in Latin America that are spending a third less on a pretty scanty safety net to start with than they were, you know, 10 years ago. Because of those institutions. I mean, and yet, there's an undercurrent in the whole international development world of a creative model. Just very simply, you take a modest amount of money, a few million dollars, a few hundred thousand dollars, put it in the hands of a basically a credit union in small ones spread across the developing country, boards of directors made up of people from the community who lend it out in very small amounts, $200, $500, $1,000 a pop, for a small crafts enterprise to get a second sewing machine, a farmer to put in a pedal pump that allows them to get irrigation water quicker and spend more time cultivating crops, some training, some new seed varieties, etc., that can have vast impact. I mean, the World Bank and the other big lending institutions are still all too often funding the mega projects, the giant dam that flooded 100,000 acres in Brazil and didn't produce a penny, you know, hasn't paid for itself yet. Well, enough of those blow up in their face, and they, you know, there are people in all of those institutions that have learned and are moving in the right direction. That's another one of those whole threads that runs across the regions of the world where, you know, they're hopeful kinds of things, but things are going to continue to move in a positive direction to the degree that there's an aware and aroused constituency, us, organized in groups like Lutheran Peace Fellowship. I think it's one of the better ones in our constituency, to effectively, month after month and year after year, learn more in our dialogue among ourselves and act on selected projects to make a difference in the world and to express in a collective fashion Christ's call to be peacemakers and justice seekers. Because in fact we live in a world that is so collective, so structured and organized that it requires really, you know, organized responses.